Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields the bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh Lord, yeah.
Hi, I'm Jim Grierson.
And hi, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 31. Grierson, I come to you live from Kansas City, Missouri, and that works out very well for us on what I think, other than the first two movies, is a very Midwestern-themed show. I am in the Midwest. We are from the Midwest. We will be discussing a Midwestern movie in our reboot section, and I believe Werner Herzog is a relative of former St. Louis Cardinals and Kansas City Royals manager Whitey Herzog. I think that's true, right? That's got to be true.
I don't think that's true, actually. In fact, I'm pretty sure that's not correct.
You know, in retrospect, it doesn't actually make a lot of sense, now that I'm thinking about it.
He's never brought up in any interview, and he does a lot of interviews, so you think at some point he would have mentioned it.
But we will be discussing a Werner Herzog movie later off. Werner Herzog's War Dogs. That feels like a tongue twister and a fun little movie that would have been a mashup of the two movies we're discussing this week. But first, as always, we remind you to follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach, GRIERSONLEITCH. In that order, if you don't have them in that order, it will be wrong and not get you to the place that you're trying to go. As always, please email us at GriersonLeach at NewRepublic.com. I'm producing the shows now. I think they sound a lot better. I'm very pleased. I think we finally have gotten out most of the wrinkles, and we're actually like a normal show. And as always, please subscribe to us on iTunes, find us on SoundCloud, and when you do subscribe to us on iTunes, please give us a review, and it helps people find the podcast, and even better, it gets your review, the name of your movie you'd like to see, and your review read aloud on this podcast as we review it for our reboot section. So we only have, because last week, if you remember, we had a crazy show where we had six new releases to discuss, and we had the reboot section. So we're only doing one reboot movie. We're going to have a very much more relaxed show. It will not make me talk any slower, but I will just not feel as if I am being chased at the last podcast. So, okay, so here is our reboot movie this week. The review comes to us from Miss Dandy, which is just this review just came to us from a week and a half ago. So see, listeners, this could be you. Miss Dandy made magic happen with this review. She made the internet happen. Subject line is one of the best! !5 stars. Let's face it, the world of podcasting is overflowing with movie podcasts. I disagree, by the way. I really only know of ours. Trust me when I say that this is one of the best. Grierson and Leach have great chemistry and offer an awesome mix of reviews of new releases and older movies. And is it wrong for me to admit that some of my favorite episodes have involved some fantastic critical takedowns of movies like Batman, Very Superman, and Warcraft? Well, I'm glad you had fun, Miss Dandy. For their reboot section, I humbly request they take a second look at the 1979 coming-of-age film Breaking Away. I know it's cliche to say, but they just don't make movies like that anymore. Well, Ms. Dandy, thank you for the kind review. But we shall be the judge of the whether or not they make movies like this anymore when we discuss in our review section, Breaking Away. But we have two major movies to get to that we've both seen. And then Grierson, they are War Dogs and Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World. Also, Grierson's seen Ben-Hur. I've not seen Ben-Hur, so I'm going to very briefly ask him about Ben-Hur. Not the original, right? You were discussing the new movie that came out with Morgan Freeman and the crazy hair.
That's correct. Yeah, the 2016 version of Ben-Hur.
And then, of course, sadly, one movie that has gotten very good reviews that neither one of us have had the opportunity to see yet is Kubo and the Two Strings. So maybe we'll discuss that on a later podcast when we've both seen it. But today, sorry, haven't seen it. But first off, we are going to kick us off. We're going to rock and roll with War Dogs.
My name is David Packhouse. I'm 22 years old, and I'm an international arms dealer.
6 months ago, I was a massage therapist in Miami Beach.
Sorry, it fell.
And now, here I was with my friend from junior high.
I think you should come work for me.
I'm against this war.
This isn't about being pro-war. This is about being pro-money.
All right, so War Dogs is directed by Todd Phillips, the director of the first Hangover movie and also the second two Hangover movies, but he'd rather us not mention that. Stars Jonah Hill and Miles Teller as Ephraim and David. They are two bros. That's really no – I. In case you're wondering whether why I'm calling them bros, they call themselves each other bros at least 100 times during this movie. They are two bros from Miami who went to high school together, and they meet at a funeral of a friend, and it turns out that Ephraim, played by Jonah Hill, is very wealthy, and they were best friends in high school. David, who's kind of struggling, though I have to say the life of a masseuse is not really as terrible as Miles as they make it sound in this movie. $75 an hour is a pretty good deal. Anyway, he's a masseuse in Miami who's really who's struggling and kind of wants to be, frankly, rich and basically like Scarface, kind of their mutual guy that they admire. He starts working for Ephraim, who, as it turns out, is a gun runner, but not a gun runner in a traditional kind of way, not in a Tony Stark kind of way, in a very specific time during the U.S. Iraq war and the Afghan war, in which small contractors were able to find deals on the internet and sell guns to the U.S. military. Well, when this happens to two young kids in their 20s, all sorts of hijinks ensue, including when they come across a shady character named Henry Girard, who's played by Bradley Cooper, and all sorts of madness happens. So, War Dogs.
I'm glad, by the way, that I am not the only person who will sometimes erroneously refer to this movie as War Pigs because of the Faith No More cover of the Black Sabbath song. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Very hard not to call it that. But the wrong mammal. We're talking about the War Dogs. Todd Phillips is kind of a fascinating filmmaker because I have to say, I am, just to give my own history on this, I think the first Hangover was and still do think it is absolutely terrific. And one of the things that I think is excellent about that movie is it's a really tight script that Phillips is able to bring the things that he's very good at, which is A, making comedy movies look a lot better than most comedy movies do. But also there's a sense that, like, if you give him a direction and stick him to the script, he is able to really, like, that's a mystery, that movie. That's like a mystery in a comedy. He allows his actors to improvise, but never go so far where it feels like it's a Seth Rogen movie where people are just desperately trying to fill air, or Judd Apatow in that, for that matter, fill air with comedy. He's better when he has a strong script to stick to. This is probably more in that vein. To me, this movie is his best movie since The Hangover, which is not a huge hill to jump over, to be fair. But I do think, I have to say, ultimately ended up liking War Dogs for a couple of reasons. There's got a lot of problems, and a lot of problems that you would suspect in a movie made by the director of The Hangover, which is like, it's more dramatic than you're probably expecting from Todd Phillips, but I still feel like it's really just kind of a surface level dramatic. It's really, the movie feels so obsessed with Goodfellas that in a lot of ways it's almost just a retelling with these dude bros, but it's still very well paced. It's not so much funny though. It has a couple of funny moments. It's almost a sneaky non-comedy. It's really not much of a comedy at all. It doesn't have a lot of laughs. But it does have, what I have to say, the best performance I've seen Jonah Hill give. Jonah Hill, the film reviewer for The Village Voice, says that he puts this movie on his back and just carries it. Jonah Hill is fantastic in this movie. So even when the movie is missing bass on a lot of ways, I still feel like ultimately it works. So I have to say, Grierson, I liked War Dogs, though I also like War Pigs.
I like War Pigs better as a song. I feel almost exactly the same way you did, except I didn't like the movie. Because I agree with all the strengths and the weaknesses. I mean, you mostly mentioned the strengths. I think Jonah Hill is terrific. I was actually, while watching this movie, thinking, is this my favorite Jonah Hill performance? I'm not sure. I may like Moneyball better still, but this is actually, I think, you know, definitely in his top two or three. It's up there with Wolf of Wall Street and Moneyball.
And this is a guy I was pretty skeptical of for a long time, but I have to say I won't after this movie. Even with Wolf of Wall Street, like, okay, he's working with Scorsese, and Moneyball, it's like, okay, that's a good role for him. But this is really, like, he's menacing in a way I didn't expect him to have ever seen him like that.
Yeah, I think that he capably plays that. I mean, the Goodfellas thing incredibly obvious, I think, in terms of what like what the model is for this movie. My review in The New Republic, one of the things I mentioned is that I feel like a movie like this really strengthens the case that outside of Pulp Fiction, no movie has been more influential in the last like 25 or 30 years than Goodfellas, because there have been so many movies that have just kind of ripped off the Goodfellas model in terms of how to tell a story. With Goodfellas, you've got the voiceover, check. You've got the you are there kind of look at a criminal underworld and how it works, check. And most importantly, and this actually comes to part of my problem I have with War Dogs ultimately, is the kind of on-the-nose song choices in this movie.
To say the least.
Yeah, Suicide Squad got a lot of grief, deservedly so, for kind of the lame classic rock choices in that movie. I find it even more distracting in this film because they're not even periods correct, because this movie is set from like 2005 to 2008. There's a lot of songs from the 90s that are used completely unnecessarily. And then you have moments where things are scored to songs that are meant to be ironic in their usage. There's a Creedence Clearwater Revival song used at one point.
It's Fortunate Son. Like the minute a military helicopter comes, they literally start playing Fortunate Son. I'm like, Oh, you got to be shitting me.
Which I thought after Forrest Gump, we had discovered that song was always supposed to be a commentary on war, but apparently we still don't know that. There's a Leonard Cohen song used at a point that's incredibly irritating, specifically because the song that they use, Leonard Cohen's song Everybody Knows, is meant to suggest a cynical, ironic, world-weary tone that the movie itself does not have. I agree that I think this movie is not necessarily supposed to be a comedy in sort of the traditional sense. I think that we are supposed to look at this movie as being somewhat cynical and ironic. But my problem is that the more that the movie goes along, it stops being, I think, a really interesting case study in these two guys. And instead it just becomes here's the Goodfellas model, and you know what's going to happen. And even though this is based on a true story, we're going to just sort of follow that model to my mind, disappointing degree. So much so that what I think the movie is supposed to be about, which is number one, can you believe that guys in their 20s were able to not rip off the government? Because what they do, I think pretty effectively in this film, is to say what they did for the most part was not illegal. They were actually working within the confines of how the U.S. government worked, where they made all of these government contracts available to, I mean, Will and I could have started a company and made bids for this stuff. And that is, I think, at the beginning kind of interesting. But this idea that this is supposed to be a commentary on the Iraq war or the kind of moral dilemma of that movie, or of that war rather, kind of falls by the wayside pretty quickly. And instead, I think what you have is, can you believe these guys got away with this and this and this? And I found that tiresome after a while. What I think is interesting is that I agree that this is Todd Phillips' best movie since The Hangover. I also agree that's a very low bar to get over. Mm-hmm. But I think what especially worked that you haven't mentioned about The Hangover is that movie, I think, also was self-critical. Yes, those guys were funny and a blast to be around, but I think that movie actually was pretty wise about the fact that those guys were jerks and in some ways were getting their comeuppance in terms of wanting to have like some brotastic bachelor party weekend. This movie also kind of wants to do that, but I don't think it's wise enough or smart enough or frankly willing to push its audience enough to make us feel like, oh, these guys are actually dicks and these are the types of people who got rich off a war that should have never happened. The movie, I think, is not smart enough or sharp enough to really kind of put the dagger in. And so because of that, I feel like the movie just kind of floats in this kind of Goodfellas kind of soup without really saying anything all that perceptive about the time period it's documenting.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I think a lot of that, frankly, is this is not Listen, I like Miles Teller. We both like Miles Teller for a long time. This is not a great performance if just because he has no character to play. Like, this character is a character type substance in the same way that his wife or girlfriend in the movie is a character type wife. there's not even really an arc for him. There's not like a notion where he learns. The only real arc he has is in comparison to Jonah Hill. Like, he learns a little bit more about Jonah Hill as it goes along and learns that he's really not his friend at all. But like, to me, the Jonah Hill character, maybe that's a factor of the Jonah Hill character and performance being so powerful, that I found every single time I was dealing with kind of Miles Teller's kind of boring little story with his wife and the very empty kind of stuff with that, I really did not find it compelling. I kept wanting it to get back to Ephraim.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way, to be honest. And I think Teller is perfectly fine in the role. It's just that character is, to use the Goodfellas model again, a more boring version of the Ray Liotta character. There's not much of a sense of what he's gaining or what he really wants other than just to be rich. And after he's rich, there isn't much conflict in that character. There's not much interesting kind of going on. You had mentioned this, and I also wanted to kind of touch on it, which is, for a long time, I've also been kind of banging the drum about the fact that Todd Phillips, I think, among comedy filmmakers, is one of the, if not the most, visually sophisticated. And I think that really comes through and actually really helps this movie, because I can't imagine really any other comedy director, not even Adam McKay, who I think did great work with The Big Short last year, I can't really imagine any other comedy filmmaker really getting the look and the globe-trotting sense of this movie as right as Todd Phillips does, because that is sort of an important component of this movie, that you do have to feel, wow, these guys are kind of touring the world a little bit and kind of getting into these kind of political hotspots along the way. You know, it's set in Miami, so, you know, you just shoot Miami and it looks fantastic. You know, in some ways, I wish this movie was more like Todd Phillips' version of Pain and Gain, which is a movie, I actually liked in terms of Michael Bay movies, because that movie had a ballsiness to it, though despite all its flaws, had a ballsiness that I wish that this movie did, and it simply doesn't have.
See, I was going to bring up Pain and Gain for the exact opposite reason, because the thing that Pain and Gain has going for it is something that's frankly not something that this movie also has going for it. It's got a really terrific, like, just grab ya idea. Like, the idea, look, here are bodybuilders that get caught up in this criminal underworld. Look, here are these two dopey kids who, these two Scarface jackass Goodfellas. You know, that's something the movie could have used, by the way, is them being aware that Goodfellas exists. Like, this sounds like a movie that these two characters would be obsessed with. If they're obsessed with Scarface, they're probably obsessed with Goodfellas. So I wish that could have been there a little bit. But more to the point, Pain and Gain is a really good story, a really fascinating, you know, I've read both of the pieces of long-form journalism that both Pain and Gain and War Dogs are based from, and they're both terrific, and they're rich, and you read those stories, you're like, oh man, someone's got to make a movie out of this. To me, Pain and Gain has so much Michael Bay dipshittery that completely loses the thread of whatever the story actually was. I think there's a little bit of that here, but it still feels like the core. Seriously, holy shit, look at these kids being involved in this stuff. Even though maybe Miles Teller's arc isn't there, and sometimes it's not entirely as focused as maybe it should be, that still central thing, it doesn't screw up that central idea the way that I think Pain and Gain did.
Yeah, and again, that movie has a ton of problems, and Bay is front and center with most of them. I mean, it's splitting hairs. The thing I preferred about Pain and Gain is that there was something that juiced that story along as it went along, where I feel like, for me, my interest dipped and kept dipping. I mean, by the time Bradley Cooper shows up, and another thing I think we should mention in terms of, to my mind, the over-seriousness and the over... I think Todd Phillips is too proud of how smart he thinks his movie is. And one of the reasons, one of the things I think is a clear indication of this is the fact that there's like chapter titles. Not since some of Woody Allen movies from the 1980s have we had like black background with white letters that are dialogue, like lines of dialogue that will show up in a couple minutes in the movie as chapter titles. This movie, I think, is too self-important for its own good. I don't think it's sort of nervy enough. And that, I think, for all of Pain and Gain's flaws, that movie sort of knew, it sort of acknowledged its dipshittery, I think, to use sort of that perfect word that you used. This movie, I think, kind of thinks it's above it and thinks it's being very daring by presenting those characters. I'm not so sure about that. Again, you know, it looks great. I think Jonah Hill is really, really terrific, but
I think Bradley Cooper's kind of, I'm not sure I understand that character entirely, but he is very compelling. He's got like a, he comes at that character from a weird kind of side angle that I kind of enjoyed, even if I never necessarily understood his inherent utility to the story.
Yeah, Bradley Cooper's kind of created this weird side career for himself, where whether it's the pilot episode of Limitless that he was on, or Joy, or this one where it's like, I'll be in your thing for like a couple scenes, and I'll just kind of have fun without chewing the scenery. And to be clear, I thought Bradley Cooper was terrific in Joy. I thought he was like one of the strongest parts of that movie. I think he's fine in this, but it is a performance that is kind of built around sunglasses. I think there's a lot of that performance is sort of that. Yeah, I mean, like Kevin Pollak is sort of okay. Miles Teller's girlfriend, fiance, I forget which, who I'm not familiar with, Anna de Armas. I'm actually not familiar. Yes. Yeah, I think she really kind of pops, but you're right. God, she's kind of stuck in the Scorsese girlfriend wife role of loving, then confused, then nagging, then kind of like the moral compass of the movie. Again, I didn't hate this thing, but to me, it just doesn't entirely connect.
All right. So what did you end up giving it?
I gave it a C+.
Yeah, see, I gave it a B. I feel like, while I agree with a lot of your criticism of the movie, I feel like the highlights of it, the fact that it looks good, it moves along pretty well. And to me, the major takeaway from this, Jonah Hill is, I will now perk up even more when I see Jonah Hill in a movie. I found myself looking to see what he was in next. This is the most, I think, fully realized, like even with the other movies where he's been really good, he's been a supporting character. He's still technically a supporting character here, but he is willing to do the heavy lifting in this movie in a way he didn't really have to in the other two movies. I just think he's terrific enough that whether or not you're down with this movie, Jonah Hill, I think, is almost himself worth seeing.
I would agree. But he's quite good. And as a longtime fan of his, I'm glad that you are on board Team Jonah Hill. So that's...
I also like him a lot more now that he's heavier. I really didn't like the really scrawny Jonah Hill. He looks sickly. I wanted to give him a sandwich. I'm glad he's back looking sweaty and upset and fevered. And, you know, another, just one last thing on his performance. I love the idea that, you know, at the beginning we're kind of told that his character is he'll be whoever he wants to be to make money out of the situation or to get it or to succeed in the situation. But I like how the performance, like, slowly starts adding to that idea, and it really becomes like, by the end of the movie, he's not like psychotic or anything, but there's a clear, almost kind of pathology to him that is almost sociopath like that. I think it's amazing for a guy like that that starts out as this kind of comic character and becomes like this sinister character while still being kind of a pathetic character all the way through. I just think it's a very nuanced, very smart performance.
Yeah, and the thing I will add to that is that using the Goodfellas model, what I am happy with in terms of the performance and the construction of the character is that he's not the Joe Pesci. He's right. Sort of the Joe Pesci, but he doesn't have the epic freak out. He doesn't have the violence explosion. There's something, I think, much subtler in terms of what is going wrong with that guy and how like screwed up he really is and what, like you said, what a psychopath he is. So 5-10 years from now, we'll say, not a great movie, but hey, that was a good performance from Mr. Hill. So.
That was a that. Well, we'll go back when he's winning his Oscar for playing Ryan Lochte. We will all look back at this and be like, wow, that's when Will finally got on board for how great Jonah Hill is.
After disappearing into that role as Ryan Lochte. Yeah.
As one must.
As one must. You're
playing Ryan Lochte.
And when we all get to that point in our lives, we must disappear. So, that's War Dogs. We'll close the door on that. So our next movie is a documentary from Mr. Werner Herzog. It's Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World.
The explosion of information technology on the internet has led to some of its greatest glories.
Could this team beat the real Brazilian football team?
That is the goal, to have a team of soccer-playing robots defeat the FIFA world champion.
In the forest, we met a modern-day hermit.
I became very ill from wireless radiation signals. As soon as I heard there was a place with no cell towers, I was here in 48 hours.
So Lo and Behold premiered at Sundance this year. It's the new documentary from Werner Herzog. It is about the internet. And if that sounds like a topic that is impossible to encapsulate in a single documentary, I would argue that that's part of the fun of Lo and Behold, because it actually actively, defiantly refuses to be an overview in any sort of exhaustive, definitive way. Instead, it is very much a Herzogian look at the internet. What he does is, through kind of like these different episodes that he films, he talks to different people who either helped come up with the internet back in the late 1970s. He talks to people whose lives have been adversely affected because of the internet, and at the same time talking to people who are on the forefront of what the internet can do in terms of connecting people across the world. He also talks to philosophers and other people about what are sort of the spiritual or ethical implications of what the internet has created in our lives, because the internet is not going anywhere. So what does it mean in terms of the fact that we have it every day, we use it every day, but we don't actually think that much about how it's actually shaped and changed our lives? I am very much down with this movie, just to start us off, partly because, you know, sometimes in the past, I have found that when Herzog is dealing, when he has his documentary hat on, he will sometimes, I think, overshadow his own subject matter because of his sort of intellectual musings about the subject matter. And because of that incredible accent that he has, that every stand-up comedian worth his salt can do an impression of, in some ways, that character of Werner Herzog has overshadowed his movies to their detriment. I think, though, that he hits, for the most part, just the right tone with this movie, which is playful, curious, bemused, but at the same time actually actively concerned about what the internet means in our lives. I haven't liked one of his documentaries this much since Into the Abyss, which is a movie that Will and I both love very, very much. If you haven't seen it, it's a movie about him talking to people on death row and also talking to the victims of those crimes. It was one of the most restrained and respectful documentaries that he's done in the last 10 years, and I think it was incredibly apt for that subject matter. I think in some ways he brings that same subject or that same tone to this movie. It's not perfect. It's certainly not definitive. But I found myself as I was watching it, thinking that the movie just kind of touches on all these great questions and all these great kind of things to ponder once the movie is over. I really, really enjoyed this.
All right. Well, I didn't. So that'll load us up right now. I agree with you. I love Into the Abyss. And I have to say, I found myself harkening back to how much I liked that movie while watching this. Because I'm sorry, you touched on this a little bit in your discussion. This movie has too much Werner Herzog pulp culture character and not enough Werner Herzog documentarian. The example, there's one scene in particular that I think the problem with doing a movie like this is you're trying to touch on so many things in so many different angles that either you have to focus on one part, or if you're focusing on everything, it almost devalues some of the other sections. And that's particularly hard when you have Werner Herzog being the Werner Herzog guy. And this is the scene I'm talking about. When he's talking to Elon Musk, who is he's the CEO of SpaceX and Tesla, and, you know, the billionaire guy, the nice tech billionaire, not the Peter Thiel tech billionaire, but like the Elon Musk, still kind of a little creepy, but not like the evil genius idea. But, you know, Elon Musk is talking about like why he wants to go to space and why he wants to do this. And literally he's about, like, you can see him. He's starting to get, like, Musk, when he starts, he kind of has this look like, okay, Werner Herzog's interviewing me. So he has this kind of like almost, you know, not skeptical, but guarded, all right, what kind of weird thing am I in right now, look on his face. But then he starts getting into it. He starts talking about the rocket and colonizing other planets. And he's just about to get going, and Herzog interrupts him. He's like, can I go on your – I'm not doing an impression, by the way. But can I go on your rocket? I'd like to get on your rocket. And it's just like, dude, get out of the way. Get out of the way. Right now, you're being the very funny Werner Herzog on Parks and Recreation, or the – what's the name of his character on Parks and Recreation? Keg Jeggings. Yeah, very funny. Very, very clever. And I understand that, like, listen – Spike Lee has taught us anything. It's that you can be a public personality and still make smaller, very personal, very powerful, very sincere movies. But I do feel like there's a lot – like when that's happening, when he's like doing the Herzog thing and he's – and I think you see a little bit more of that when he's – there's a section where they all go out to – there's people that remind – as a guy that loves Safe like you do, I thought you might enjoy this, the little like commune where they all go to get away from the internet where they think it's making them sick. And I feel like there's a whole movie just in that place, but Herzog can only kind of touch on it a little bit and then still get a little bit too Herzogged in there. And I think what happens is the more he's front and center, as I think he is a lot in this and is less so into The Abyss and is the more and more that you do that, the harder it is, for example, when what should be an absolutely brutal scene where he's interviewing the family of Nikki Katsouris, who is the woman who was killed, the teenager who was killed in the car crash and had very grisly car crash scene police photos taken, and they end up getting out to the internet. And you see like their pain in this palpable way that, frankly, I think this movie is too bouncing around in light, and I'm Werner Herzog and look what I'm doing. For a movie like this, I think it's too much for a movie like that to be able to hold on to that tone.
See, that's really interesting. I understand what you're saying. I just didn't find the Herzog character to be that intrusive. The Musk thing, I had forgotten about that, so that's a good point, because I saw this back in Sundance. But I have to say, for the most part, it didn't bother me. And for the charge that it's kind of too all over the map, I gotta say, your mileage may vary, obviously. But for me, there is something about the idea that the internet itself is this big thing that you can kind of bounce around and go from this thing to this thing, from something very serious to something very kind of playful, all in the matter of a couple clicks. That works for me in the movie. I actually find the sort of sample way that he does this, going from thing to thing, usually that bothers me. But it doesn't bother me in this. And the more serious moments, like the ones that you mentioned, to me, they have a real power, partly because they are like stacked up against other things. The movie, for me, makes you think about the fact that the internet brings everything to you. It brings everything to your computer. And the question is, what are those things that it's bringing? And the fact that those things are so different from each other, or could be, depending on the type of person you are, how is that changing us? How is that making us think of things as they're connected to each other? And for me, that works in this movie. And I agree that the elements of that, those people who are like wanting to get away from the internet because they think it's making them sick, of course, that made me think of Safe. That's one of my favorite sections in the movie. But it feels like the right length, because for me, what it says is there are all these other things, and if you want to find out more about them, you can go online and learn more about them. I actually think that works in the film.
You know, and another thing too, there's certain sections that I think are on their own are pretty entertaining. Like there's a section where he interviews Kevin Mitnick, the hacker, who talks about how he had fun with the FBI and when he would hack into their systems, and how he would do it really just as a trophy. He wasn't trying to get rich. He wasn't trying to get wealthy. And it showed how guys like that could be really powerful in that regard. But again, like I found each one of these things, I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. And then he jumps off to something else, which again is a general problem if you're making a movie about the internet. But I think that is the issue, is it feels like Herzog a doodle on a whole bunch, and it's a very entertaining doodle. Like there's a lot of really fun stuff in this movie and a lot of stuff I enjoyed. But I just feel like it feels like a short film anthology stitched together uncomfortably. And I found my, it was probably on last podcast, you asked me about Spaceman. Spaceman. Sorry, I don't know why I keep saying Spaceman. But he asked me about that movie. Would this be better as like a 30 for 30 short? And I said, yes, it would be. There's a lot of stuff in this that I'm like, no, I want more on this. I want to get more into this thing. The Korean gamers who wear diapers so they don't have to go to the bathroom when they're playing. That's a fascinating thing. That's another thing I wanted to see more of, and I couldn't help but feeling like this was just too little of a bunch of good things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things you either feel it or you don't. And for me, it works because I thought, oh, this each of these things gives me just a little something I wish I knew more about, but now we're moving on to the next thing. And I liked how it kind of, I keep saying this, but I'm going to say it again. It surfs the web, I think, in a really fun way. And I think that, though I understand your point about the Herzog character, I think that's what I'm saying in terms of the playfulness of this movie or certain elements of this movie is that the movie, he knows inherently he can't put his arms around this whole thing. So he's going to look at pieces. And I think that those pieces are in and of themselves provocative and interesting enough that I was willing to go for it.
Well, I would recommend everyone. It was funny. I even though I had a lot of issues with this movie, it did. Like, he can still do things that remind me how much I loved Into the Abyss.
Yes.
To me, Into the Abyss is the encapsulation of why not for some people that'll be Grizzly Man. For some misguided people, it will be Bad Lieutenant. But for I mean, hey, you're with me on that movie.
Oh, I'm with you on Bad Lieutenant. Yes.
So, but for me, that is what he does best, is to be able to take this very serious thing and not only tackle it from a philosophical nature, but also, and not only tackle it in his kind of deadpan finding the absurdity and humor in things, but also that's, I feel like, his most human movie. I feel like the thing I love about that movie is he takes a step forward toward the people of the movie, when I think in his lesser movies he takes a step back, and I think this is a movie where he takes a step back.
I totally agree that Into the Abyss is the better of these two movies. I think that's an underseen movie, an underloved and underappreciated movie. I think this one is good too, though.
Well, Tim, appreciate my rhetorical trick of taking a great movie and comparing it to the movie that you like that's not as good. Therefore, I come across looking better. Zang!
Oh, you got me. You got me again, Leach. You got me.
Exactly. All right, so what'd you give it?
I give it a B+.
Well, I give it a C+. I'm actually a down on this one. I found myself surprised at how unsatisfying that I found good old Werner Herzog. It did make me go back and watch his Parks and Recreation scenes again, though. And they are very funny. So,
did it make you go back and watch Jack Reacher, though?
It did not make me go back and watch Jack Reacher. But the idea that Keg Jeggings is selling off this old haunted house so he can move to Orlando to be closer to Disney World is one of the funnier things.
That episode has not been on reruns in syndication in a while. I need to reacquaint myself with that episode. So
Parks and Recreation is the best. All right, so that was Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World. So we're going to do very briefly for 5 minutes or so. Again, we remind everyone we have not seen Kubo and the Two Strings, which has gotten very good reviews this weekend. We're going to try to see that and discuss that at least briefly on a later podcast. But the other big movie opening this weekend that I have not seen and Tim has, so I'm going to ask him some questions about it, is Ben-Hur.
How long were you a slave of Rome?
5 years.
What is your name?
Ben-Hur. My family was betrayed by my own brother. I won't let him go unpunished for what he's done to us.
There is a way. Defeat your brother in the arena, and you'll have your vengeance.
Should have stayed away.
You should have killed me.
All right, Grierson, we're going to make 4 questions because the first question is just going to be the basic. Hey, Grierson, what the hell is this movie about?
it's a tale of the Christ, Will.
Oh, okay. Well, a good second question then.
So it stars, there's been several Ben-Hur big screen versions. The one that's best known is the 1959 version that won 11 Oscars. It starred Charlton Heston, who won an Oscar, playing the Jewish Prince Judah Ben-Hur. This time that character is played by Jack Houston. His best friend turned rival is Toby Kebbell, who is an orphan who goes off to the Roman army, becomes a big muckety-muck there. They become enemies. Judah Ben-Hur gets arrested, gets sent off, has to work in the galleys of a battleship, and it's about him getting revenge on his old friend, Toby Kebbell. And Jesus shows up at one point.
That's handy. Well, first off, Jesus is always around as Christians, so don't act like there's something special about Ben-Hur, okay? But he's actually cast by an actor this time.
Yes, that is correct. He
that doesn't count my second question. Okay, so my second question is, Ben-Hur is, again, not only one of the most famous, often film stories, including basically in Hail Caesar. They kind of have a notion in Hail Caesar of Ben-Hur. Why is there anything that justifies another Ben-Hur movie in the new Ben-Hur movie?
For the filmmakers, the justification is that this was produced partly by Mark Burnett and his wife, Roma Downey, because they make religious film,
faith-based.
Yeah, I was going to say religious-themed, Christian-based movies. And this one, you know, all of the Ben-Hur movies have an element of Jesus in them, obviously, so it's not like this one necessarily needs to have it because other ones haven't. That's the reason why they made it. For me, that's the crux of why this movie, though not without its pleasures, I have to say, doesn't really need to exist because there's nothing in this movie that hasn't been in earlier Ben-Hur's, other than the fact that now you can see it in 3D and you can see some of the effects and big action sequences with CGI.
Okay, now my third question, this is actually a key one. The director, can you say the director's name for me? Because you know what happens when I said that. He's a Russian Kazakh director, Timur
Bekmambetov, I think is how you say it.
So you just said it phonetically like I would have, so I just made you. I just made you do that. So now you've kind of famously, you hated Wanted, which was like his big movie that was one of his, well, was probably one of his, that was kind of his biggest hit, but you did kind of like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Is this movie good because of him? Is bad because of him? What works in this movie? What satisfies you?
What satisfies me in this movie is that the Charlton Heston Ben-Hur, which I'm actually not a big fan of, and it's 3.5 hours long, and that's partly why I'm not a big fan of it, has been stripped down to about 2 hours for this film. And I have to say, I didn't miss much from the 3.5 hour version in the 2 hour version, because it basically preserves that brotherly rivalry, it preserves the Jesus element, and it preserves the big action set pieces that were big in the 1959 movie. I will say that I don't mind the fact that this one is shorter and it kind of gets to its business a lot faster. As someone who is not a big fan of the 1959 version, what you miss out on is a lot of pontificating and a lot of Charlton Heston doing his Heston-esque stuff in the movie. You don't have that. Instead, what you have is Jack Huston, who I think is a perfectly fine actor, pair with Toby Kebbell, who I think is also a very fine actor who has unfortunately been saddled with. He was in the Fantastic Four movie from last year. He is great in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And so that dynamic between those two actors, I think actually works pretty darn nicely in this. It moves along at a pretty good pace. And also, you had alluded to this earlier, Morgan Freeman plays a sheik who is not too scene chewing, I have to say. Morgan Freeman actually kind of brings it in this movie. It's not overly ponderous. It's not overly serious. The reason why I liked Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter is I think that movie knew how ludicrous it was. And it stuck to that. And within that, the confines of being kind of camping over the top actually was weirdly kind of emotional because it sort of knew. It knew its place. I think this Ben-Hur kind of knows its place as well, and I think that that works to this movie's credit. The two big set pieces that people remember from the 1959 movie, the big battle at sea and the big chariot race, are very exciting, and they're very well done, and I got a kick out of watching both of them. So those are the things I enjoy. What I didn't enjoy was the Ben-Hur-ness of this movie.
Well, I have to say, Grierson, it kind of sounds like you liked it.
I would say that I didn't like it, but I didn't dislike the experience of watching it. This movie, this movie is, it would be, a, if we're talking thumbs up and thumbs down, it's a thumbs down because it doesn't really need to exist. And there isn't a lot of interesting new wrinkles in this movie. So as you are watching it, it's mostly, it's not entirely a great parallel, but it would be like watching the Gus Van Sant Psycho. It's an intellectual exercise to say, oh, okay, so this is what this filmmaker did and these actors did with a classic that everybody knows, and so we can kind of compare contrast in our mind as we're watching it. But in terms of an actual movie experience, it's pretty negligible and kind of like the 1959 Ben-Hur. It doesn't, it can't entirely fit its more sort of Christian message against the more rah-rah action stuff.
All right, so what'd you give it? C plus full?
I give it a C, C plus.
C plus.
It's a C plus. Yeah, it's a C plus. It's not quite as good as Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which I think for most normal human beings would be a weird way to compare any two motion pictures. But it is simply not as fun as Vampire Hunter for obvious reasons, and that's to the detriment of the overall film.
All right, so there is Ben-Hur. So I have to say, Grayson, though, I would say there's a 99-1 chance. I am far more likely to watch this movie than the 3.5-hour Ben-Hur before I die. Like, I'm getting older, Grayson. I'm in my fifth decade of life now. The idea of what I know, right? The idea of doing a 3.5-hour Ben-Hur or a just fun, easy Morgan Freeman bringing it Ben-Hur, I'm much more likely to watch this Ben-Hur.
Yeah, my only thing I'll say about the 1959 one is that I had never seen it until about 2 weeks ago, and I thought, well, I should see it in preparation for this Ben-Hur. You know, I don't think in terms of when people rank best picture winners, it tends not to be very high. People don't have a really high opinion of this movie in general. It's not a slog, the 3.5-hour version. It's actually better than I was sort of expecting, but once the chariot race happens in the 1959 version, you still have like 45 minutes of Ben-Hur, and that is slow death in that film. So, yes.
All right, so that is Ben-Hur. So so there are the three movies that we discussed. And again, next week or the week after, some point, we will get to Kubo and the Two Strings because people really like that movie. But now it is time for our reboot section. Our reboot movie is Breaking Away.
Aren't you glad we got fired from the A&P? I mean, right now, we'd be working.
We didn't get fired, Mike. You got fired. We quit.
Well, all for one and one for all.
You know, there ain't many places they're gonna hire all four of us.
You know what I'd like to be?
Smart.
Cartoon of some kind. Wouldn't that be great? You know, like when they get hit on the head with a frying pan or something, and then their head looks like the frying pan with the handle and everything. And then they go boing, and their head comes back to normal. Wouldn't that be great?
How'd you get to be so stupid, Cyril?
I don't know. Guess I have a dumb heredity or something. What's your excuse, Michael?
Breaking Away came out in 1979 and directed by Peter Yates. It was nominated for four Academy Awards, four or five, and it won the original screenplay award for Breaking Away. It is the story of a bunch of guys. And I think everybody wants some exclamation point. Exclamation point will probably come up in this conversation, but It is definitely the everybody wants some of 1979. It stars Dennis Christopher, Dennis Quaid, Daniel Stern, and Jackie Earle Haley, who play impossibly young people. How are they ever this young? Oh my God, they're so young in this movie. Playing high school guys who are looking to the future, looking to graduation, looking to their adult lives. They live in Bloomington, Indiana. Dennis Christopher plays the main character in the story. His name is Dave, and he is a bicyclist, and he is in love not just with bicycling, but almost with Italian bicycling culture, much to the annoyance of his father, played by Paul Dooley. And the movie is, as are reboot reviewer mentioned, it is the type of movie they simply do not make anymore. It is about a guy and his bike and his buddies and him falling in love with a girl at the local college and him trying to win a race, mostly for his own like enjoyment. He's not trying to beat anybody necessarily. He just wants to race because that's really the only thing that he actually cares about in his life. Now, Will, I have not seen this. I only saw this movie for the first time maybe 3 or 4 years ago. It was kind of one of those like late 70s gems that had just sort of, I just sort of missed. And I finally had caught it. But last week on the podcast, you had mentioned that you and your dad had seen this. You were pretty young, I take it. How long ago had you first seen this movie?
I was still living at home, but I wasn't like eight. I would say I was probably in the probably early high school, maybe 15, 16 years old.
Okay, so my question to you is, watching it in high school back then, if you can remember, did it resonate? As you mentioned before, we grew up in a small town in Illinois, so they grew up in Indiana. It's somewhat analogous. Watching it in high school, did you feel like they were speaking your language, they were living your life? How did it resonate?
You know, it's funny to, because I don't remember, I had to, before, because we chose this week, I had to kind of remember one of the things I recollected the most about enjoying this movie so much. And I actually remember enjoying the sports movie stuff more than that. I knew it took place in the Midwest and in the town that I know that I've been to many times. So, you know, I knew that, but I don't think at the time I was like, yeah, Bloomington's like Matt Toon. I got to get out of this place. But I will say watching it now, it was much more resonant. Like this was not a, for me, you and I discussed this before, but you know, us being from a very small Midwestern town, to me, the stuff that resonated with me for wanting to like go do things were not, here's someone in my similar situation. It was Kurt Cobain is doing amazing things. There's all sorts of amazing things happening outside of Matt, Illinois. I should go see what those things are. So it was less like there's someone like me that wants to get out of here as much as it was that. But that theme of this, what's funny about this is not so much that these guys really want to get out of their small town, which I think is a thing that really I thought resonated very strongly with me, because this, maybe we're going to get too personal for you, Grierson.
Uh-oh.
But okay. I know we're starting to get real on this one. But Tim has always had a much more does a little bit about our hometown. Our hometown has about 18,000 people, probably less now. If you've been back recently, it's hit some harder times. But you know, my parents are still there. Your parents are still there. But I will say that you have a much healthier, in my opinion, have a much healthier attitude about Matt Toon than I do, because you it's where your parents are. You'll go back occasionally, but otherwise, you know, you live in Los Angeles. You've lived there for a long time. Whereas for me, I wonder if it's because I've lived in so many cities. You've lived in one city since you left Mattoon. I've lived in so many cities that will always feel like home to me, even though it's a place I don't actually want to live and don't think I'd be able to live. And therefore, I have kind of this conflicted thing about it. Now, this is about more of a college town, but I still feel like that thing kind of clicks, the idea that I'm just going to be this guy. Like, there's this great speech that Dennis Quaid, who is awesome, by the way, talk about a guy popping off the screen. Like, it's so funny to watch, to go back and look at the people that were nominated in this movie. Like, would you have thought Barbara Barry, this is the girl, would be the one that would get nominated?
She's the mom. She's the mom.
Forgive me. And she's good, but like, I would have thought Paul Dooley would have been that. I would have thought, and to me, Dennis Quaid, there's a, oh, that's a movie star right there. Like, that is what a movie star looks like, to watch him in that. But like, he gives this really great speech where he talks about how he's like, you know, I'm just gonna, no matter what happens, I'm just gonna, I forget the name of his character in the film, Bob or James or Joe or Tom or Frank or Harry or whatever it is. But he basically,
I think it's Mike.
He's like, listen, these college kids are all going to be the same age all the time. It's like the sad version of Matthew McConaughey's speech. Right. Yes. He's like, these college kids are all going to be the same age. They're all going to be perfect forever. But I'm just going to be Mike. And then I'm going to be 20-year-old Mike and 30-year-old Mike. And then he jumps to old people Mike faster than I'd like him to. But the general idea is, you know, he's just going to be the same guy and life's just going to pass him by staying in this town. And I found the way that the town, the way that Bloomington is portrayed, and the way that everyone is very thoughtful, and everyone is, even when they're flawed and even when they make mistakes, there's, everyone gets the little moment. I found it like this big-hearted movie in a way that made me nostalgic for being home, but not in a fake nostalgic, like, oh, why can't it be 1950 again by science or magic? But really, like, felt like kind of earned in a way that I have to say touched me a little bit more this time than even while seeing some of the movie's flaws I may have missed the first time. I found it actually a little bit more touching this time than even when I saw it last time.
That's really interesting. I mean, all of that. And I don't disagree that your connection to Mattoon is very different than mine. I would say that because I've lived in Los Angeles since moving to college to go to school there, yeah, Mattoon is – it's funny because Mattoon is a place that is very close to my heart because my parents still live there and I still have friends who live in the area. But it's more of a – I mean, it really is more of a state of mind as opposed to a physical location for me in a lot of ways. But what's interesting to me is that I have spent most of my adult life really loving slash being very critical of movies about the Midwest or the Heartland or the real America or whatever you want to call it, depending on the movie, and feeling a very strong emotional connection to those movies. Anything from, say, I mean, Junebug is always the one that kind of jumps off to me, but I think a lot of Jeff Nichols movies that aren't necessarily always set in the Midwest specifically, that those resonate in a way. So it's interesting that, I mean, I say all that as a preamble to say that I am definitely predisposed to feel an emotional connection to movies set in the Midwest. It's funny for me that both times I've seen Breaking Away, both a few years ago and this week in preparation for the podcast, I very much appreciate this movie, but I don't feel as deep an emotional connection to it as I might think I would. And I think as I was watching it, I was kind of struggling with, what is it? What is it? And I think it's partly the fact that there is something, and I think it works for people who love the movie, there's something kind of beautifully unconscious about the way this movie kind of plays out. I think it's fair to say that this is not exactly an exhilarating or scintillating piece of cinema. It's very relaxed. It's very like relaxed and kind of languid and lovely in terms of how it's put together. And it very much matches the mood of its main characters, who spend most of the time just hanging out. They're hanging out. By the way, talking about how movies are not made this way anymore. Every time any of the characters jumped off that rock into the water, I kept thinking, "Oh my God!" The legal concerns they must have had, the health, the safety concerns they must have had for this movie. There is something that feels very, like timeless or out of time about this movie. That while I appreciate it, I can't say I can entirely connect with it. You and I are both big fans of Everybody Wants Some, and when you talk to people who like that movie but don't love it, maybe you've experienced this yourself, Will, I will get comments along the lines of, "Yeah, it's good, but it just, you know, it just didn't get to that next level for me." And because I love that movie, it drives me crazy because I think, how can you not see that movie? How can you not see it? That's kind of my response to Breaking Away. I like it. I think it's good. I like all four of the central performances of those kids. They're so young. They're so young and they're so beautiful, I have to say also. Like, they're just so gloriously young in this movie that it's just kind of like amazing to watch. I think some of the stuff with his parents, it feels a little sitcom-y. It doesn't get quite to that level, but it's not quite as strong. But on the other hand, I love that we don't necessarily build to a big race. There is a big race at the end of the movie, but I kind of love that it's almost, he's not trying to prove anything. Or, I mean, he wants, you know, his dad comes to respect what he's doing, but that's not really what it's about. It's about him just kind of loving what he does and frankly winning the race. Uh-oh, I gave away the ending. Winning the race is almost not the point. The point is that he wants this in his life. This is a very important element in his life. And so I don't want to be too harsh on the movie. I would just say that I found it lovely and touching, but it didn't reach me on the level that I know it reaches people who love this movie.
Yeah, and I, you know, I have to say, I think you're not giving enough credit to the relationship with the parents, particularly the father. There's a very, I think at the beginning, he's a little bit, they dial it maybe a stitch too close to the Christmas Story dad. I'll grant that.
Yes.
Like it's a little bit of the dials of one twist there. But then I think it settles down a little bit and you start to see the dad of his own. There's that really great, almost silent scene where he goes to the factory and you see him like just having a little moment where it's this thing that he loves and values. And you see a little bit of kind of what his son is like and what he's gotten from them. I think the scene that probably got her Oscar nomination, and I think is one of the more powerful in the movie, is the scene where he comes back after, by the way, Italian bicyclist, total dick.
Yeah, I was going to say that. So basically what we learned is those guys are total jerks. They're just like,
seriously,
because I'm pretty sure like that's not allowed, right, in bicycling, to throw like a projectile at another bike.
I'll have to ask my friend Jason Gay, who writes for the Wall Street Journal and knows cycling as much as anyone. I he'll be happy to hear this, by the way, because I famously hate bicyclists in New York City. they've ruined every great experience of walking around in the city by making you now have two vehicles that that can hit you at all times, but only one of you will sneer at you, one of them will sneer at you for being in their way. But anyway,
real fast, I have to tell you, you will be very thrilled to know that while watching this movie, I thought, yeah, Will hates bicyclists. God, he hates bicyclists. So I was thinking of you while watching this movie.
I love cyclists that follow the law. I love cyclists that follow the same rules the rest of us follow on an everyday basis. All I know is I've never had a car almost hit me on the sidewalk going the wrong way and then yell at me for being in their way while they did it.
That used to happen
to me on a bike every day in New York City.
This is, by the way, the episode 31 will be known as the realest of all our podcasts. We're talking about Matt Toon. You're exercising your bicycle demons. This is, Dr. Katz over here. Look at this.
But I do think that, I think Paul Dooley's really good in this. And I think, because it starts out with a little bit of a Gleason quality. And I think it humanizes him and becomes stronger to where that's a certain type of Midwestern dad. And one thing I think that resonated with me too was, and this is the last thing I'll get real on you on about Greer, is, you know, I mean, movie is also from a time where going to college was a really big deal that was almost seen as not as access for a lot of people. And I'll say that, like, you know, my father has 8 brothers and sisters, or 7 brothers and sisters counting him, and I was the first of them to go to college. And like, it was like, it's sort of like a weird thing. Like, my dad didn't go to college, and his dad didn't go to college. Like, college was seen as this thing, you know, that other people did. And it was something that was very important for my father to say, no, my kids are going to go to college. After he paid the bills for college, I think he's like, you know what? You should have become steelworkers. I think this movie captures that kind of idea very well and captures a certain type of, not necessarily my dad, but a certain kind of Midwestern dad. And to me, that's the scene I was talking about earlier where, hey, after he comes back and after the dick Italian bicyclist, just like not only like mess with his gears, but then literally he could have killed him. Like he was going like 50 miles an hour on that bike and they stick a pipe in his spokes. Like that, you'll kill a guy on that.
You don't bring a knife to a gunfight, man. That's just the way, that's the cyclist code right there, dude.
Yeah. Seriously. After he comes back from that and is very upset and seems to have this realization, like, I just didn't realize that everybody cheats. I don't, it's very upsetting. And he goes to hug his dad, and his dad is just like, what is happening? What is happening? But still can tell that this means something. And you see the mom clearly very moved by it. That is a scene that I think resonates pretty strongly from my experience of growing up in the Midwest. And it evoked that probably. I don't remember this as I knew it took place in the Midwest seeing it younger, but I never thought of it probably because I hadn't lived in New York for 13 years. I was just like, yeah, this is just like outside, right? Like everything is like this because it looks like this where I'm from. But it resonated a lot more with me as a Midwestern movie this time than when I saw it initially.
It is a great point. I'm glad you brought up that. Yeah, there is something about, and watching it now, if you were like 15 years old and you watch this movie and he's like, I'm not going to go to college. It's like, you're not going to go to college. Are you just like throwing your whole life away? Where, yes, at that time, that was a reasonable decision to make in terms of one's in one's life. So
I also love the idea.
I have
one last thing I want to say, Gerson. One last thing I want to say about Jackie Earle Haley. Because, you know, Jackie Earle, when he came back with little children and now he has a successful career, I forgot that he played Freddy Krueger briefly. But I kind of love the fact that if you look at this is after the Bad News Bears movie. And he'd made like 4 of those. It was like a pretty big star. He's Kelly Leak. But this was, you realize now, this was like his I'm a grown-up now movie. And then didn't make one for like 5 years and then was never the same after that. So I think it's kind of funny that the biggest star, if you look at the credits for this movie, it's everyone listed and then and Jackie Earl Haley. Like, he was the big star coming into this movie. And of course now, to me, I have to say also, this made, last thing I'll say, this made me want to go see a Dennis Quaid movie because he's so charming and like perfect in this movie.
Yeah, he's lovably like langly or gangly rather in this movie. Yeah. It's yeah, it's he's very fun in the movie. There's no doubt about it.
All right, so that's Breaking Away. So that was an excellent, excellent. Thank you, Miss Dandy. That was an excellent, excellent. I was very. This is not the best movie that we've done in reboot, but it might have been the one that I responded most strongly to.
Wow, those are strong. We've seen Quiz Show on this, and yeah, that's high praise, high praise.
Well, we saw Rear Window. I mean, Rear Window.
It was Rear Window, right? Yes.
But I do think that this was I was very moved by it and very happy that I got to watch it again. So that is Breaking Away. So go see Breaking Away, everyone. It will make you happy. And also, I also love the fact that in the movie, the University of Indiana like is seen as, woo, it's the Indiana's football stadium, which is like the lamest football stadium in the entire Big Ten, by the way. But whatever, to these guys, it's a big deal. All right. So that is the end of our show, Grierson. I said we were going to go deeper on our movies this time, and I think that is exactly what we did.
Yeah, I'm actually very curious. You know, we talked about this last week, because some people really love when we go really deep. I get the impression that some people also kind of like our lightning round thing that we did last week. So you can't please everybody, obviously, but we'll switch it up every once in a while.
I do feel like this is more of our natural comfort level. Last week, I felt like we were sprinting.
Yeah, I was pretty tired after last week. So I did need like to lay down after that one. That was tough, but we did.
That was intense. Intense podcasting is what we did that time.
Yes.
All right, so we'll be back next week with episode 32 of the podcast. We actually have no movies that we're going to discuss next week. We are going to do on the New Republic next week. We will be doing a big end of summer wrap up. It'll be our only piece next week. Basically, it's just going to look at the summer and just look at the things we love from the summer, some of the best movies, some of the best smaller movies, best performances, kind of takeaways. We're going to do that in the podcast next week. So we'll just have that kind of free ranging discussion. And then we have two reboots. Movies, and both of them, I think, I wouldn't say they're thematically similar, but you know, they're the movies that you will remember from your youth and may or may not get really mad at us for not appreciating enough. So
I was going to tease it by saying these are movies that if you like them, you're probably pretty emotional about them, and so yes.
So the first is Almost Famous from 2000, directed by Cameron Crowe. I think whatever your thoughts about this movie, it was the last time where people were like, wow, Cameron Crowe's a really good filmmaker. It's been a long time since then. But that, of course, is about the band Stillwater, starring Kate Hudson, Patrick Fugit, Billy Crudup, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and yes, Jimmy Fallon. Because you've forgotten about that. Jimmy Fallon is
I had forgotten that. Yes. Now I'm a little less excited to see this movie. I have to revisit this movie, I have to say. Philip Seymour Hoffman will get me back in there, though, so it's okay.
Yes, yeah, of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman as Lester Banks. And then our second movie came out 4 years later, but I think it's similarly emotional to a lot of people. It is Garden State, Zach Braff's emo shins, whatever thing it was from 2004, written and directed by Zach Braff, starring Zach Braff, and also starring Zach Braff as Natalie Portman, Zach Braff as Peter Sarsgaard, and Zach Braff as Jim Parsons, and Zach Braff as Ian Holm. He's got range.
People try to dismiss this, but it's very true. He's got range. I already can tell. I cannot wait to have a conversation with you about that movie. Yes.
Yes. We have much to discuss. We're going to have our general discussion about the summer that we just had, and maybe just the general state of summer movies in general. And then we'll talk about Almost Famous and Garden State. So good show, Grierson. I'm pleased with how this one went. I have to say, maybe people like the lightning round more. I feel kind of like free and cool right now. I feel like we did a good job.
Yeah, that was very fun. We also kind of fun to dip into the Mattoon lore during the podcast. I think people enjoy that on occasion from us, hearing about that stuff from us. Yeah.
Well, Bike, I don't care about the on occasion because I have to say I would like to have a special Mattoon story hour every episode now at the end of every show.
Yeah, that will be consistent. Will telling stories of our youth and me saying, I don't think that's how it happened, Will. I'm pretty sure that's not right, Will. I'm pretty sure it's not.
I had to hear every single goddamn person from New Jersey talk about Garden State for 10 years after that movie. I could talk about Matt Dune on one podcast. What exit are you from? What exit are you from? What exit are you off from? Jersey people. All right. This is the Grayson and Lee podcast.
We're shedding listeners left and right. This is amazing.
Yeah, I know. I love New Jersey. I do actually quite love New Jersey. I generally liked New Jersey more than Garden State, but we'll find out that next week. So thank you as always for listening. This is the Grayson Lee's podcast. You can see us, of course, on Twitter at Grayson Lee's. Leave us a review in iTunes. We'll be back next week. Grayson, see you, man.
See ya.
In order to survive here, we have to become like animals, and we have to forgo all sense of civility and understanding. How is it possible that a nun can fly? How is it possible that he falls out of a plane and lands unscathed? But who are we?
Who are we to scoff at such things?